There we go. That's better. Okay, so something happens very quickly between chapter 4 and chapter 5, and it's a whole lot of years and a dynasty change and a whole lot of things go on. And so if you will tolerate it, I'm going to give you one brief slide of ancient Babylonian history. We'll run through it as quick as possible, and then we'll get into the story. But verse 1 starts out with King Belshazzar. Guess what? We don't even know who that is yet, right? No one has. It just picks up right there like you're supposed to know who that is, and we don't. So the story goes something like this. Nebuchadnezzar, who's been the king so far in the story, reigns from 605 to 563 B.C. He's followed by his son-in-law, Labashi Marduk. Marduk is the name of the chief Babylonian god that everybody loves and adores in Babylon. So this is Labashi Marduk. He's named after their favorite god. And it's his son-in-law. He reigns for a grand total of 9 months. And there is a coup, and someone else takes over, and it's almost like he had never been. There's basically no record of him doing anything. It's very brief. The person that takes over is Nabonidus. He leads the coup in 556 and takes the throne along with his son, Belshazzar. Okay? Nabonidus and Belshazzar worship a different god than Marduk. And so they want to institute the new religion in Babylon the best they're able, and it is not popular. So Nabonidus reigns for a considerable period of time, and some of these dates are iffy. I noticed a couple of them don't match up, but, you know, it's one slide. It's what you get. Nabonidus, in order to institute the religion of his god, kind of goes on a campaign around Babylon for 10 years and leaves the capital. He, odd little bit of history, he begins the first ever archaeological project known in human history. Right, he's an ancient Babylonian digging up even more ancient Babylonian sites and trying to show that this is the god they used to worship and we should go back to that. So he's restoring old temples and he's traveling around doing this, leaving his king, or his son, Belshazzar, as co-regent in his place. Babylon becomes weak under Belshazzar and while Nabonidus is away from the throne. And so as the Persian threat grows, Nabonidus finally returns to Babylon in about 543, and he and his son remain there for a few years until the fateful night. Rarely in old ancient history we actually have a date. We do for this. October 12th, 539 BC. Some of those dates are iffy. That one is not. That one is pretty well set in stone. If you believe any part of this story actually happened, and we do, then that date is fixed because of the historical records we have. That is the night these events took place. So, all that to say, Nebuchadnezzar's gone. His son-in-law was overthrown quickly. Father and son take over the throne. Belshazzar is the son ruling with his father, actually the throne. But Belshazzar is the son who's co-regent. And neither one of them are very popular, and neither one of them are doing very well. Oddly enough, they do claim Nebuchadnezzar as their father. Okay, if you're a really lousy king, you know what you do? You say, well, that important king was my dad, you know. All the Caesars, you know, all the emperors of Rome said, well, you know, we're basically the adopted sons of Julius Caesar, don't you know that? And so that's what they do. They refer to, and in this chapter, it'll refer to their father, Nebuchadnezzar, but there's no indication they're even related. It's their predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar, to whom they claimed part of the lineage. Okay, now, verses 1 through 4. See, it wasn't too painful. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Okay? So that's the setup. That's why I said you got to have a little of the history to make sense of it. Nebuchadnezzar was a famous king. He was a conqueror. Nebuchadnezzar had carried off plunder from other civilizations. He had raised up monuments to himself and commanded the whole world to worship him. And he had built up Babylon itself into a city that was mighty and great, so much so that his pride got him into trouble in chapter 4. Belshazzar knew how to throw a party. That's how their accomplishments compare, right? If you're the petulant young king who wishes he was Nebuchadnezzar, what do you do? Well, I can throw a big party. I mean, you can really get into once you get the history a little bit, you get into the mindset of what's going on. He has no accomplishments. And so he invites in all the nobles and he puts on a big show. And he has no accomplishments. But you know what? Nebuchadnezzar, my predecessor, he carried off all kinds of loot. So go dig that out, right? This will make this a really classy party. Go dig out all that stuff we looted from other civilizations. Like, you know, that temple they had in Jerusalem, we've got all that stuff, right, in a closet somewhere. Pull it all out and we'll use that as party serving wear. Right? And they use that in a festival that honors the gods. Important for two facts, it's definitely not the god of Jerusalem, is it? But on top of that, it's not even the god the Babylonians liked. He's immensely unpopular in his own country because he doesn't worship their gods either. So the idea you're getting is that this fellow really doesn't measure up. But he's doing what he can, throw a big party, because that's what you do when you have no accomplishments. It refers to Nebuchadnezzar as father. The ESV even footnotes it as grandfather or predecessor. And that's the sense of it, is not literally his father, but rather the great king who came before us, our nation's founding father, Nebuchadnezzar, right? So that's the way that's been used there. The sacred vessels had been taken as a judgment against Judah's idolatry. Remember, that's how Babylon got him in the first place. Israel had been guilty of idolatry, so God allows the temple to fall and them to all go into exile. Well, guess what? Now the Babylonians are committing the same sin with the same instruments that the people of Judah had done. How is God going to view that? Right. So now they're going to inherit a judgment of their own in this particular passage. So the famous scene, if you don't know anything about chapter 5, this is the scene you probably know. Even if you don't know, you know it. And it is the handwriting on the wall. Somebody want to read for us? I think there's too many awful names in there. Verses 5 through 9. James, go ahead. There's no wrong way to pronounce Belshazzar. I've said it 3 times tonight. They're different. So whichever way you want to do it is great. Okay, that's the scene you know. I mean, handwriting on the wall is still an English expression we use, even if we don't know where it comes from, right? The handwriting's on the wall for that politician, or the handwriting's on the wall for that program, right? It means the end is near. Okay, well, this is the story it comes from, and the handwriting's on the wall. When you dig into this 5 or so verses, it's a really meaty section of details that are really fascinating to consider, at least I think they are. What would normally be written engraved on the walls of the king's palace? Belshazzar, so awesome. if you go to an ancient archaeological site, if you maybe go to Egypt, something like that, what kind of things do they put on their walls? All their accomplishments. Here's all the great things that I've done. Look at me, I'm fantastic. Belshazzar, so awesome. Now, for poor Belshazzar, he doesn't have a whole lot to put up there, which is maybe kind of part of the joke of this particular scene that plays out. This would be a palace full of Nebuchadnezzar's accomplishments, and Belshazzar can throw a party. You know, I mean, that's about what he's got to brag about. There's not much to go up on the wall. And so finally, somebody puts something on the wall for him, but it's not him that does it, and it's not what he's looking for. Instead, what writes on the wall? Say it louder, Bobby, because I'm going to correct you and make fun of you. Go ahead. Yes. It actually says, and I don't know if this matters or not, the fingers of a hand. So I don't know if there are these dismembered fingers floating through the air writing on the wall or not, or if you're just supposed to take that as the whole hand. But they're usually connected, aren't they? But yeah. Some sort of hand mysteriously appears in midair and is writing on the wall. The word for write here and elsewhere in the chapter is not referring to pen and ink. It would be better translated as inscribed or engraved. Ancient writing, and I have an example of it there on the screen. Babylonian type writing would be in some sort of cuneiform type writing or something along those lines. And the way they would write, not with pen and ink, they would take a kind of triangular instrument like you see there, that's their pencil, and you'd take something that was clay but not dry yet, and you would press into it a series of marks and triangles, kind of like you see on the screen there, and that was the way they wrote their language. Then you bake it, it dries, and now your writing is preserved forever and ever. We still have Babylonian writing and Persian writing. In fact, if we get far enough into the lesson, I've got a little picture of the Cyrus cylinder, which you can still, I think you may have to go to Iran to see it, maybe, but it is in a museum. You can go see it. And that writing, you can still read it because it's baked into clay, whereas Shakespeare a few hundred years ago, we can't find anything he wrote on, right, because pen and ink disappears. But that kind of writing lasts a very long time. So normally, you'd write this into wet clay. So imagine you're Belshazzar and you're walking along and there's a perfectly normal solid stone wall and someone starts writing on it, pressing into it as if it were clay, the writing of your language and inscribing or engraving words on it. Yeah, it's going to alarm you a bit. It is a strange image. Just if it were just pen and ink, that would be strange enough. But to have a perfectly solid wall suddenly be inscribed in the manner of their writing would be very unnerving. The text describes how unnerved he was. Now let's compare this to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had a bad dream, and it says he was alarmed, and he called for his magicians. But he kept his wits about him. He issues order and so forth. Belshazzar is not quite the man Nebuchadnezzar is. Belshazzar, it says, his limbs gave way, which is a polite translation. Literally, his knots came undone. Probably a euphemism for he soiled himself. He came undone inside. So here is this powerful, thinks he's powerful king, throwing the great big party and showing off. And suddenly, he loses control of himself. His knots come undone. And there's a play on words here that, again, just nerdy things going all over the place. The same word for knot is used later by Belshazzar when he says to Daniel, can you untangle this riddle? And he uses the word knot. Can you untie this knot? Well, his knot's already untied. It's all over the place. But that's kind of the description. It's a story that is intentionally making fun of Belshazzar as a joke, compared to Nebuchadnezzar. Proud and foolish as he was still an impressive figure. Belshazzar isn't even that. Okay. Who can see the writing on the wall? Doesn't actually say. I don't have an answer to that. He tells his wise men, can you read it? And they say, we can't read it. And I don't know. It could mean that they saw it and couldn't read it. And I'll give you a reason for that later on, why that could be. It's also possible, but nobody could see it but him. Wouldn't that be strange, right? It's right there. There's words right there. And they say, yeah, well, we can't read those words. So it doesn't even say anybody else could see it but him. But I suspect they could. It just doesn't say it. So just food for thought. I don't know. Yeah, if he says there's writing on the wall, you say, yes, sir. And, well, we can't read it either. so maybe that's the way it plays out. That's a possibility. There's a couple of commentators that take it that way. Most of them think that everybody could see it, but nobody could read it. Well, why not? Why can't they read it? We're going to think about that as we move through the story. These are learned men. They can read whatever language you throw at them. Here in a few verses, when Daniel reads it, they're ordinary words. It's not like magic angel words that only Daniel can read. They're ordinary Babylonian words. So why can't anybody read it? So we're going to get to that a little later on, but just keep that in mind. And then the next detail that's fun, what does he promise to make whoever reads it and interprets it? Third in the kingdom. Skipped a step, didn't he? Why can't he be number two in the kingdom? He's only number two. He can't give that spot away. That job's not vacant. And so he does the best that he can do. Now when Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dream, he says, you're second in the kingdom. He can do that. But Belshazzar says, well, I'll make you number three. You can be number three, whatever that amounts to. Because that's the best he can do. Again, Belshazzar is kind of second rate. Okay. Enter the queen mother. Who wants to read verses 10 through 12? Thank you, sir.
The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you, or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers.
Yeah, verse 12, too.
An excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show you interpretation.
Okay. The queen. Who is the queen? Again, the ESV footnotes this, and some Bibles do, some don't. Queen here does not necessarily mean Belshazzar's wife. It could. Probably, I don't think that it is, because she tells like she's older. Well, I know what happened back before in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. So it could be his mother, Nabonidus' wife, maybe. It could be his grandmother, okay, further back even, the queen mother. Or it could be Nebuchadnezzar's widow, who is still lingering around. Whoever it is, she's a little bit condescending. Well, in the days of your father, the king, you know, your father, the king. And she says it twice. There's no reason in the text to repeat that twice. You know, the king, the actual king who actually did things. In his day, there was a man who could explain all these riddles. And he put him in charge of all of the wise men. Now, I know, Sonny boy, you don't remember that, and you don't even remember his name. Oddly enough, his name is Belteshazzar, which even sounds like your name, but you don't remember who he is. And so, think of this as a story that's poking fun at Belshazzar. You're a second-rate king throwing a party. You're embarrassed. You've made a mess of yourself. And then Mama comes in and says, well, I know who you should ask. And he's terrified enough to do it, right? He doesn't send her away. He can't send her away. It's the queen mother. So he does the only thing he can do, which is go ahead and call for Daniel. But then listen to what he says to Daniel, and listen carefully. Verse 13, then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, you are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I have heard of you, that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems, untie knots there, literally. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple, and have a chain of gold around your neck, and shall be third ruler and the kingdom. So what does he say? He's a bit defensive there, in my opinion. My slide's not advancing. There we go. He's a bit defensive. You're that Daniel, right? He doesn't know who he is. You're that Daniel. Who are you? You're the exile. Now, he hasn't been an exile in decades, if you think about it. Nebuchadnezzar had promoted him to head of all the wise men in Babylon. He's been a court official now for decades. But how does Belshazzar say? You're that exile that came up from Judah. Now, I had all the wise men come in and look at this. Did he have all the wise men? Not the head of the wise men, because that was Daniel. He had his favorite wise men come in, the ones who told him things he liked to hear, and they couldn't tell him. And so I guess I'll have you, Judite, come in and tell me about it. And if you do, I'll make you third in the kingdom. So he's a little bit defensive. He doesn't say you're wise and clever. He says, I've heard that you could be wise and clever, and you might could do this. Right? So it's a very petulant response when you think about kind of the way the story's playing out. And Daniel takes it that way. Verse 17, Daniel, who's always very polite, this is the closest he comes to firing back, okay? Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. Now you can keep it. Give somebody else third in the kingdom. Your kingdom isn't worth much. Wow. What kind of a man refuses a gift from the king? One who's been around a while. I mean, that's a good way to get dead, you know, is to tell the king, your presents aren't good enough for me. I'm not interested. Your promotion isn't good enough for me. I don't want it. But somebody who's been around a while and has seen a few things, the queen mother can get away with sassing him, and so can Daniel. Daniel says, no, I don't think so. It also reminds me, have you ever been working at a company and they get bought out by somebody else and the current boss tries to negotiate and give you orders and stuff and you say, yeah, I think I'm going to wait on the next guy. You're a short timer here anyway. And Daniel has this sense that you're not going to be around long anyway, so what do presents from you mean to me? But sure, whatever you say. And that's, again, it's as, he's not rude, but it's as fiery as we see Daniel in any of these texts, where he is just always perfectly polite. He says, keep it, don't want it. Belshazzar doesn't warrant that kind of respect from Daniel. So let's hear what the God of heaven has to say in these words. He says, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father the kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. Who did God give greatness to? When he talks to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, he says, God gave you glory. He tells Belshazzar, well, he gave Nebuchadnezzar glory. He hasn't given you much anything. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and who he would, he humbled. Again, emphasizing that Belshazzar, you haven't done any of these things. Nobody cares what you say. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you. You and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and of gold and of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, and do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways you have not honored. Get goosebumps just reading that. He's not even talking to me. It is as direct and challenging, again, as we'll ever see Daniel in this book. It is the grim voice of judgment. Okay, the Most High God gave your father, quotation marks, great Nebuchadnezzar, your predecessor, he gave greatness. And still, he humbled Nebuchadnezzar. You're not nearly as great as Nebuchadnezzar, but you haven't learned humility. You have insulted the God who humbled the greater king. That's not very smart. And that last line, ooh, the God whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways you have not honored. I love that line. You think you're powerful. You breathe because he lets you. And if he decides you stop breathing, you'll stop. And this is the way you've treated him. The vessels of his temple are drinking cups for your prostitutes. Daniel a little angry today? He is burned up. Okay? And he's laying it out pretty plain. So, then from his presence this hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. Okay? Move the head here. There we go. And this is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, mene, tekel, and parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Why could Daniel read the words and no one else could? Assuming they could all see it, which, you know, is reasonable. It's possible that they were written like a lot of ancient languages, like Hebrew, for example. Hebrew is written only in consonants. So if I put a bunch of consonants on the board and say, tell me what that says, it's a riddle. There's a lot of ways to put that together. I've mentioned this before. It's my favorite Hebrew joke. One of the guys I worked with early on was named Marion, and he always commented that in Hebrew, you would just put MRN, which could be Marion or moron, and you just have to interpret it when you saw the letters as to which way it was. So you see these letters up on the wall with no context. And they're not, you know, pointed with vowels or how you're supposed to say it. And there's no paragraph to make sense of it. And it's just a riddle. Three words, no context. It would be essentially impossible to read. Especially if they were boring everyday words. Where you're looking for deep meaning and you just have penny, nickel, dime. Which is essentially what's written on the wall. The words could mean, I pulled up a couple commentaries, and I wanted to know, what are all the possible readings? If these consonants that he reads off are written on a wall, how many different ways could you read it? And several of them tried to list it. You know, it could mean numbered, weighed, and divided. Number, weigh, and divide. Mina, shekel, and half mina. Appointed is the Persian trap. What shall I weigh? A half mina? Who has caused Persia to stumble? Whoever you are, Persia is insignificant. I mean, there's literally a dozen or so different ways you could string those letters together. And you can imagine the wise men of Babylon staring at it and saying, no idea what that means. Even if they could make it out, if it was a language they recognized. Larry? Which is exactly what you would do, right? If you wanted to make a point, you'd make sure it was the kind of thing nobody was going to get anyway. So you have this riddle up on the wall. And so Daniel reads it as a riddle about weights and measure. Literally, the words he gives, mene, tekel, and parson, are the words you would use for Babylonian weights. So ancient money, they don't have coins yet in that normal sense where this is worth so many pennies, that kind of coin. What they had was money by weight. And so you talked about money in terms of weight. One weight was a mina, which is the first word, and then shekel, tekel, and then half mina, which is parson, which means literally a divided mina. So penny, nickel, dime. It's description of weights. Again, literally, what does that mean? Nothing. Penny, nickel, dime. Go ahead, interpret that for me. It could mean anything. And so you can imagine them all scratching their heads. A most powerful being in the universe wrote on the wall, and what did he write? Penny, nickel, dime. I don't know what that means. Daniel says, I'll tell you what it means. Mene was the word for mina, but literally it meant numbered. So the picture is of God in a marketplace, and he's picked out some weights, and he's numbered you. He's assessed you. He's decided about how much you're worth. Tekel. God has weighed you in scales like money is weighed. See what you're worth, if you're worth anything. He's counted you up. He knows what you are. Now he's going to weigh you and see what you're worth. What happens if you have something and you don't think you can get your money back out of it? If you own a big, big piece of property somewhere and you just don't think you can sell it for what it's worth, well, you might be tempted to divide it up into tracts and sell it off. The last word is divided. Daniel says, God has divided you as you would to sell off a losing investment or property. You think you're the most powerful man in the universe, and God has counted you, he's weighed you, he's divided you up, and he's going to sell you off by lots to the Persians. And the last word, Paris or Peres, even sounds like the word for Persia, so it's even a double riddle there at the end. He's going to divide you to the dividers. He's going to divide you to the Persians, and they're going to have what's left of you because you're a losing investment. Nebuchadnezzar was ahead of gold, but he's got your number. You're not worth that much. And so he's going to divide you up. Does that kind of make sense what he does with the words there? That's the best I can do with it because I don't speak ancient Akkadian and I wasn't there. But that seems to be what's going on when he gives you the words and says, here's what they mean. It has this sense of numbered, weighed, and found wanting. That word tekel, preachers I grew up around, tekel was one of their joke words. That when you made a bad argument, they'd say, tekel, tekel, weighed and found wanting, Bill, tekel, tekel. Not a good argument, you know. So you have to be a pretty nerdy preacher to enjoy that, but those guys did. Tekel, tekel. So that's basically the sentiment. What does Belshazzar do with that? The God of heaven has decided to cut up your kingdom and sell it off because you're worthless. Well, he does what he said he's going to do. Belshazzar gave the commandment, and Daniel was clothed with purple, chain of gold put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be third ruler in the kingdom. Daniel had said, I don't care. It doesn't mean anything to him, but if you want to throw a party for him, go ahead. It doesn't matter much because that very night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was killed. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So the judgment is swift. One commentator I read thought it was funny that the fall of the Tower of Babel had been a story of pride that God had judged with language, and the fall of the legacy of the Babylonians was a story of pride, and he judged them with some languages on the wall and stuff they couldn't read. I don't know if that's important or not, but I thought it was kind of funny and worth mentioning, both Babel and Babylon being connected there in the story. The history of the story is fairly legitimate. I mean, as I said, it's anticlimactic. It's all build up, and then in two verses, and that night he was done. And that's about what we know from history, the best we can gather. Ancient history is really hit or miss. You just get little fragments and pieces. We do get a little bit of this. Nabonidus seems to have survived. Belshazzar is never heard from again after this night. That is the end. The story, as it goes, we have on one of those clay tablets. I don't know if you can see very much of it, but this cylinder is written all the way around. This is the Cyrus cylinder, and it's Cyrus recording his great triumphs, and it's written into the cylinder, kept for all the time. And I can't remember. It seems like the Iranians still have this because they're very proud of it, but I'm not sure. It's in a museum. And you can see him recording what happened. And here's one section of it. Cyrus says, Marduk sent me. Remember the beginning of our story? Nabonidus and Belshazzar had changed gods from Marduk to Bel. And Cyrus says, well, Marduk sent me to take Babylon back. And so he says, his vast army, meaning Marduk, right, whose number like water of the river cannot be known, marched at his side fully armed. He made him enter his city, Babylon, without fighting or battle. He saved Babylon from hardship. He delivered Nabonidus, the king, who did not revere him, into his hands. The story goes that Cyrus's general diverted the water of the Euphrates. So there's a river that flows into Babylon, and he just diverted it. And now that river makes for a nice road underneath the wall, and they just marched in. And the Babylonians, who didn't like their king anyway, threw him a party. They had sieged a city nearby. They never sieged Babylon. They just walked in the front, well, underneath the front gate, through the canal, and he was heralded as king. Nobody fought back because they never liked the other guy anyway. Belshazzar was tried and found wanting. Yes. Glad I have a slide on that. See, I anticipate your every need, Lenora. So who is Darius the Mede? This is probably one of the greatest historical riddles of the book of Daniel. The short answer is, we have no idea. In history, there is no one who is ever called Darius the Mede outside of the book of Daniel. There is a person named Darius the First and Darius the Second, Darius the Great, who runs Persia after Cyrus, decades later. But that can't be that person. It's not the same person. That's a future king. And to our knowledge, he's not Median. The Medes and Persians, yeah. So there, yeah, it's depends which historian you ask, but yes, they're different people. But it's kind of like, is Alexander the Great Greek or Macedonian? Well, technically he's from Macedonia, but if you ask all the people they conquered, they said he was Greek. So there were some Medes and there were some Assyrians too, in with the Persian leadership, and it's kind of hard to tell. So it's not Darius the Great who's later. I was confused about that. I thought they were the same guy a couple of years back and then stumbled on to the fact they didn't live at the same time. There's two popular options. It could be Daniel's own name for Cyrus. Kings had lots of names. If you read the rest of that Cyrus cylinder, the paragraph where he gives his name is actually a paragraph long. I am Cyrus, the great of so-and-so, son of Cambyses, the something of something of something of something of something. He's got titles this long. So it could be that Darius is a title of some kind and that Daniel knew him as Darius the Mede. Could be. Because in the book, he almost never refers to Cyrus, even though it's universally understood that Cyrus is the one who takes from Babylon. And in the book of Ezra, Cyrus is called by name. In the book of Isaiah, Cyrus is called by name. He's mentioned a couple of times in Daniel, but not often. He's mentioned in chapter 1, where it says, Daniel stayed in Babylon until the time of Cyrus, but it never tells you Cyrus comes to power. And he's mentioned at the end of Daniel chapter 6, after it's been talking about Darius, and then it says, and such was the days of Cyrus. So it could be that Darius is just another name for Cyrus, and that would make sense of a handful of passages that otherwise are a little confusing. Yeah. That's kind of what I'm suggesting here, is that Darius is some kind of title that Daniel would refer to Cyrus by. And evidently it's a title because after Cyrus is somebody called Darius, and after him is somebody called Darius the Second. Well, maybe we numbered it wrong. Maybe Darius the First is Darius the Second, and Cyrus is Daniel's Darius the Mede. You know, that's a possibility. It's just hard to say. But yeah, there's lots of titles like that. Herod, there's lots of Herods. The Ethiopian eunuch worked for a woman named Candace. Every queen in Ethiopia was named Candace for like several hundred years. So either she lived 300 or 400 years, or there were lots of Candaces. The Ptolemies in Egypt were all named Ptolemy. For hundreds of years, they were all named Ptolemy. Which is confusing, because in astronomy, there's a famous Ptolemy, and he's one of them, but he's not the first one. Okay. So it very well could be one of these titles, and Daniel says, yeah, that's old Darius the Mede. Father of Darius the Other, and Darius the one after that. Another possibility that sometimes gets suggested, there was a general that worked for Cyrus who actually led the army into the city. His name was Gaburu, And it could be that Daniel calls him Darius the Mede, and that he's made governor of Jerusalem by Cyrus, and that's who Daniel interacts with. Could be. I don't actually have an answer for that one. Third option is that somebody that history lost track of. K.A. Kitchens is my favorite Old Testament historian, and he has in his book that's this thick on Old Testament history, he has one sentence. And it says, and then there's Darius the Mede, who's an ephemeral character we do not know. And moves on. So it could be that just, you know, history never wrote his name down. You know, that do you think you have everybody that lived in the time of Babylon? You know, it's been a while. We lost a few names. So it's possible that there was a third fellow that we just don't know about. But I mention all that to say that it is interesting. This chart, I don't know if you can read any of it, but this is the Cyrus the Great is the one who conquers Babylon. And he's the one who sends Israel back in the book of Ezra. His daughter is Atossa, and his son is Cambyses. Atossa marries Darius, who we call Darius I, but again, could have been Darius II or III, for all we know. And then his son is Xerxes the Great. His son is Artaxerxes, who we know from the story of Esther. Okay. So all these names end up in the Bible somewhere. Nehemiah works for Artaxerxes, but it could have been Xerxes. I can't remember. You can go read Nehemiah. It's in there. He's a cupbearer. So all of them are in the Bible and trying to sort out who's who in a world where people had lots of names anyway. It's complicated. It's even possible, if you want to flip over a page, in Daniel chapter 6, verse 28, so this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. The word "and" there might be also. That is, Darius the Mede, who is also the reign of Darius or Cyrus. Darius, who is Cyrus. There's another verse in 2 Chronicles that does that for another kingdom and says, this guy, who is this guy? And it puts two names together so you can connect them. So it could be. It was a bad day to be third in line of the Babylonian succession. Yeah, absolutely. It was a succession that was coming to an end that night. So he says, no, you can have that. Yeah. Is there another hand? Question? All good. Everyone understands Persian history? I spent way too long investigating Persian history this afternoon, trying to figure out that one reference, because I knew if I didn't, Lenora would ask, and I wouldn't have a slide about it. All right, next week, chapter 6, we'll finally get some lions into this book.